Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how idolizing Miles Davis led a Valley trumpet prodigy to a career in comedy.
And why a group of ASU law students had asked the university to revoke an invitation to an upcoming job fair.
But first, much of the news about Venezuela over the last few weeks has focused on the United States' capture of former Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. But Venezuela has been in the headlines for much of the second Trump administration, largely due to the president's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act. The 1798 law is being used to justify fast-tracked deportations of Venezuelans, with the administration claiming that the U.S. faces a clear and present danger from Venezuela's Tren de Aragua gang. This comes as the population of Venezuelans has grown by 119% since 2019, with some 1.2 million living in the U.S. as of 2024. Venezuelans are the fastest growing group of Hispanic people in America, and many of them came here seeking asylum from the Maduro regime. A recent three-part series in Luminaria takes a detailed look at the story of two such people, a Tucson couple named Yesenia and Mariano. John Washington wrote the series, and he joins me now. John, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. And just to say up front, this piece is so extensive, and we're barely going to be able to touch on all of it, but I did want to ask you, why did you select the story of Yesenia and Mariano in particular to tell in this piece?
Well, my connection with them begins almost a year ago on Valentine's Day 2025, when I got a call from a family member who told me that they had gone missing, that Yesenia and two of her children had gone missing after an arrest on the south side of Tucson. And they were concerned that potentially they were in Border Patrol or ICE custody and asked if I could try to find them. As a reporter, I started making some calls and found out that the next morning they had been already deported to Mexico.
Yeah.
So I was able to start tracking the family. I was able to keep in touch with them, and I sort of followed their journey, which is very long, as you say, very harrowing, over the next 7 months. And I just stuck with it and was able to meet them again in Mexico and just try to understand what the actual impact of a swift deportation like this really means for a family.
Yes. Well, as you just alluded to, they had arrived in Tucson after journeying some 5,000 miles in their attempt to reach the U.S. And one of the things that you cover extensively is what was involved in that journey. And that's one of the things that really stuck out to me about your reporting is the astonishing level of detail. To give listeners just one example, Yesenia initially flees her home in Venezuela because her ex-husband is physically abusive. He has, among other things, attacked her foot with a hatchet.
That's right.
That means that she can't walk long distances in shoes, which becomes an issue when she has to trek hundreds of miles through the jungle. So she wears sandals, which then gets sucked into the mud, which means she has to make a lot of the trip barefoot. There are so many examples like this, and that is hardly the most harrowing. What was important to you about that level of granularity in telling this story?
You know, there was another moment that really stuck out to me, and this is an answer to your question. This is after she was deported with two of her four children, and the family decided that they couldn't remain apart, so they wanted to reunite together in Mexico City. Yesenia was in the very southern Mexico with two of her children. Mariano, her husband, was in Tucson. They both made the journey into the towards the middle to Mexico City. That entailed being arrested. That entailed traveling by bus. Yesenia was undergoing very serious physical malady at that moment, which turned out to be a miscarriage. She didn't know that until later. She was on the back of a train, on the top of a cargo train, stopped in the middle of the night in the jungle, two of her children sleeping at her feet. And in order to protect them, she grabbed rocks to try to fend off potential bandits that were coming. And the fortitude that she was able to muster in that incredibly harrowing, dangerous, exhausting few weeks of being oppressed and being detained, being deported, I think that's something that we don't always see. What happens after such a deportation? It's not like their story just ends because they're out of this country, because they're on the other side of the border. But they survive. They figure out ways to survive if they can. And this is something that I think is important to understand, is what this actually looks like beyond yeah. just the number.
As we've been discussing, this story is largely about Yesenia and Mariano as people. But it is also a story about the immigration system, obviously, both right. here in the U.S. and in Mexico. And one of the major systemic storylines here is how the Mexican government is handling people who are deported there by the U.S. Tell us how that impacted Yesenia.
Right. So not just Mexico, but Mexico has definitely been a partner in the United States in the immigration enforcement regime, being willing to accept Venezuelans, for example. There's other nationals that they accept as well that are deported from the United States. So obviously those people aren't originally from Mexico, but Mexico is willing to receive them. They could decide not to. And Trump has threatened tariffs if they were to make that decision. But it's not just being a willing partner in receiving the migrant, but then what we see is in practice, the migrants are often persecuted or robbed or jailed in Mexico as well. And that's all of that and more is what happened to Yesenia.
Well, as I said, John, there is obviously so much to cover in this story, and I know that we have just barely scratched the surface. So I want to encourage listeners to go check out John's reporting in Arizona Luminaria. John Washington is the reporter who told it. John, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
ASU has launched a new effort to bring back students who started their college careers but didn't graduate. Operation Comeback aims to help those students go back to school and get their degrees. That includes financial assistance. Nancy Gonzalez is Executive Vice President and University Provost at ASU. She says the program launched about a month ago and has seen around 700 people say they're interested in trying to find a way back. When she came by our studios earlier this week, she told me higher education has done a pretty good job nationally of getting more students into college, but it needs to do a better job of helping more students complete their degrees.
If you look at national data, about two-thirds of students who start at a four-year institution earn a bachelor's degree within 6 years. That means roughly one in three don't. And over time, that gap between degree completers and those with some college but no degree adds up. Depending on how you count it, somewhere between 37 and 43 million working-age adults in the U.S. today have some college credit but no degree.
That seems like an awfully big number of students who start college but don't finish.
It's a very big number, and it is a failing of higher education, and that's why we're putting the emphasis on that particular marker along with everything that we do to just make sure we create pathways for more students in. We want those students to succeed when they're with us.
I can think of and I can imagine any number of reasons why students who start at ASU or any other university aren't able to finish. Is it typically things like life happens or they can't afford it anymore or they decide that they want to do something else with their lives that doesn't involve college? Like, are those kind of the reasons why people leave without finishing?
Absolutely. It's really important to understand that the decision to leave college is never, almost never, due to one bad choice. It's a combination of factors, and you've identified many of them very well. Financial pressures, academic pressures, or sort of, you know, lack of a clear understanding of what their goals are at that particular time in their lives. Family responsibilities, mental health challenges, sometimes feeling disconnected from the university and its role in their life. All of that can add up and, you know, lead students to make that choice. Luckily, these are all things that institutions can do something about.
Well, that's kind of where Operation Comeback comes in. How are you trying to bring these, I guess, former students back into the classroom to finish their degrees?
So first, what we need to do is reach out and identify students and make sure that they understand that we are here for them. What we provide them is tailored advising, clear pathways back, and financial support that makes returning more possible. And so really connecting with the students is the first step.
Obviously, for those students, I would imagine that it's helpful to get their degree. Are there bigger sort of societal reasons to do this as well?
Absolutely. You know, one reason really has to do with student debt. Student debt actually becomes much more problematic when it's paired with non-completion, simply because those students are more likely to struggle with repayments and they don't have the earnings boost to be able to pay back those debts. A recent study by Brookings showed that people with a bachelor's degree earn about $10,000 per year more than those who went to college but didn't complete. And over the course of a lifetime, the difference really adds up. Estimates are on average about a $1 million difference between those who complete and those who didn't. I would say it also goes beyond higher education. There's a recent national story, I think, in Fortune magazine that talked about the fact that employers are increasingly looking to degrees to make hiring decisions in a world where AI now allows people to tailor their experiences to job positions. We're finding that employers are more and more trusting the credential as a signal of a student's ability to work hard and to succeed.
Is this being paired in any way with, you talked about counseling and advising, is this being paired in any way with identifying students who maybe are at risk of leaving and trying to stop them from departing before they graduate in the first place?
Those efforts are already ingrained into what we do, which is trying to understand when students are having financial barriers, when they're having personal difficulties, or when, you know, they're just kind of struggling with academics. We have a saying, which is raise your hand. So we always are telling our students, raise your hand and we will find ways to support you. Not all students either get that message or hear that message. But this is an effort that extends it even to those who have since, you know, have not been with us for some time.
Sure. Let me ask you about another group of students that there have been questions about lately, and those are those from other countries. There's been so much talk about international students being nervous maybe about being allowed back into the country if they leave or being forced to leave the country if they're here. What has the situation been like over the last, let's say, couple of months at ASU, which, of course, has a pretty good number of international students?
We do. We have a very large population of international students. We're actually the fourth largest across the country and the largest public university in terms of the number of international students we have. So we've been working very hard to help students understand that ASU still has a place for them and also for our current students to feel connected and not to feel threatened. You know, certainly students more and more are questioning, and so we've been working very hard. We did all across the summer to help students persist in their efforts to find a way to get here.
Have you found fewer international students on campus now than were, you know, let's say last year at this time?
Yes. I think there are some countries that the barriers to be able to get here are particularly difficult. We have a large population of students from India, and so the number of students who were able to get visas have declined because the visa interviews have been paused, and that's had a significant impact on us as well as most other universities.
One other thing I'd like to ask you about before I let you go is research funding. There's, of course, been so much discussion about the federal government pausing or canceling research grants. ASU's a big research school. What has the impact been so far?
Well, we have had several grants canceled. I think more challenging has been all the various shifts that are happening in the research landscape with, you know, executive orders that have been challenged and then perhaps get reversed, and with changes in funding levels being announced and also those now being challenged. So we're waiting to see, you know, how all of that will play out and just making sure our faculty are supported and they know that they should continue to advance their research and doing all that we can to support the research faculty and infrastructure, because it is so important for our success.
What has all that uncertainty meant for not just the research, but as you referenced, the researchers doing that?
I think many of them, depending on what areas of research that they are engaged in, are needing to rethink their future directions and try to plan for pursuing the newer opportunities that seem to be a priority. So that's a responsible way for our faculty to make decisions about their future research. They're typically trained very broadly and are very talented. So it's not as if one grant gets canceled, they don't have other opportunities. Now, having said that, I do want to acknowledge that it's very challenging for faculty, particularly those who are early in their careers.
Yeah. Are you nervous that some number of faculty or researchers are going to decide that it's not just ASU they don't necessarily want to be at, but this country is not the right place for them to be and they'll pursue their research somewhere else?
I think the risk of that is a real risk. I think we've seen a lot of talk about that, but less moves at this point. You know, it's pretty attractive to be a researcher in the United States because of the ways that that research is supported. I think the bigger concern are young faculty or students on their track to becoming a professor who may rethink their decisions. And, you know, the brain drain and the loss of that talent would really be, you know, a big problem and very concerning.
All right. That is Nancy Gonzalez, Executive Vice President and University Provost at Arizona State University. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a musician who left behind two full-ride trumpet scholarships to pursue stand-up comedy.
But first, the state has created a new active management area, the 8th in Arizona. That means there will now be rules on groundwater pumping in this basin, located in La Paz County in western Arizona. The State Department of Water Resources started the process of looking into making the designation this past fall. Governor Katie Hobbs announced the new AMA during her State of the State speech last week. La Paz County Supervisor Holly Irwin has been calling for a new AMA in her part of the state for years, and she joins me now to talk about its creation. Supervisor Irwin, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
So what is the current situation in La Paz County as it relates to groundwater?
I can honestly say, being with two bills that got introduced last week just after the AMA was announced, you know, I take a look at our situation in La Paz County as being the sacrificial lamb to supplement water to the urban areas.
How so?
Because we do have three basins that were created as transfer basins back in 1991, and that includes Butler Valley, Harquahala, and also McMullen Valley Basin. And two bills just got dropped on Thursday in relating to Butler Valley and McMullen Valley. So, which is very concerning because we did get protection, you know, with the AMA that was created. And I'm extremely grateful to Governor Hobbs for paying attention to rural Arizona and the residents that have been calling for protection. But now the fight's not over. We have to now try to protect the other ones from water moving out of our county.
And just to clarify, transfer basins means that that water can be moved to another place, Maricopa County, Pima County, a place like that.
That's correct. Yes.
So what are these new bills aiming to do? Like what is the concern in your mind that they would do?
Well, you know, any water that leaves, you know, a county to supplement another, I think would be detrimental to the county that currently holds those basins and that water. You know, we are already experiencing land subsidence, wells going dry within the McMullen Valley Basin. And now there's legislation dropped to allow for water to be moved out of that area when we're already experiencing some hardships with our basins in certain areas of La Paz County.
So how comfortable do you feel then with this new AMA? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like it's great, but you don't feel all that comfortable.
No, I'm very comfortable with the AMA designation for Renegros Plain Basin. That basin is the only one in La Paz County that was not included in the 1991 Transportation Act. But it currently does not have any protection on it up until now, you know, with the efforts of Governor Hobbs and ADWR, you know, to create that AMA to allow for protections to be on that basin. So it was critical.
Okay. What have you heard from your constituents and your neighbors, both about the new AMA designation, but also maybe about these other bills dealing with the other basins?
Well, the constituents are ecstatic. You know, they believe it's a long time coming. I think that they finally believe that their voices were heard. It's unfortunate that it's not being allocated throughout the other basins, you know, with the transportation, statute that's in place on those. They're extremely concerned. Like I said, the bills just got dropped last week, so I'm not sure how much of it is out there yet to the public. I've been reaching out to my constituency to let them be aware that this is something that, you know, we have to fight against and not allow for water to start moving, you know, out of La Paz County within those other basins.
Have you had any conversations with Governor Hobbs or with her office about these bills and encouraging her to not sign them should they get to her?
I'm working on that. I've not had a conversation with her. However, Governor Hobbs has been out to La Paz County back in May of last year, and she did meet with some constituents that do reside within the McMullen Valley Basin that did lose their wells.
Mm. So what will the AMA designation change for La Paz County? Like, will things be different, like noticeably different with that designation in that basin?
Well, what it will do is it will prevent any major water users being able to come in and start up a business, drill wells, and, you know, just continue to pump like we currently have one particular business in, you know, that is pumping a lot of water out of the ground, and there's no regulation. So it will prevent any future ones from coming and doing the same type of practice, and it will prohibit the current one from being able to expand. So, you know, you kind of take a look at it like we got to stop the bleeding somewhere, and mm-hmm. this is the best way to do it. It's not a perfect fix, but it's the only one that we have right now until an alternative can come, you know, can be created, you know, through the legislative process.
Well, I mean, given sort of the nature of groundwater, that it's much easier to remove than it is to replenish, what other,
right.
You know, options might be out there to sort of make La Paz County water whole again?
Yeah, it's, you know, until we can stop the bleeding from the massive pumping that's going on throughout La Paz County, specifically in my district. You know, unfortunately, we don't have the water that's replenishing those, you know, those basins. So, you know, the next best step is we need groundwater protection to at least slow that process down.
Something better than nothing, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. That is La Paz County Supervisor Holly Irwin talking about the new active management area announced by Governor Katie Hobbs last week in La Paz County. Supervisor Irwin, thanks so much as always. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
The Phoenix City Council approved a controversial new law that puts new restrictions in place about providing medical care in public parks, and harm reduction groups are not happy about it. They are the force behind recent drops in overdose rates in Arizona, and now they say they won't be able to do their life-saving work for the homeless in the place where they are most likely to be found, city parks. The ordinance prohibits any group from sponsoring or advertising medical treatment in parks unless authorized by the city. And it bars groups from using parks for needle exchange programs, as well as handing out harm reduction kits, which aim to protect drug users and prevent overdoses. Parks staff say it's necessary to stop kids from finding needles in the parks and ensure everyone can enjoy them. But our next guest this morning says it's only going to make the problem worse. Scott Greenwood is the CEO of Sonoran Prevention Works, a harm reduction organization that's been behind the flood of naloxone that has helped reduce overdoses in our state in recent years. He's a constitutional lawyer of more than 30 years, and he told our co-host Lauren Gilger, this law is unconstitutional.
It violates the First Amendment. I mean, this ordinance is really at the intersection of the two areas in my career that I emphasize as a constitutional lawyer. It's both law enforcement practices and First Amendment activity. Mm-hmm. So this is really sort of the perfect storm. And so I knew that I had to testify, even if we had plenty of other people from the harm reduction community available.
Okay, so let's back up for a minute and talk about the broader context here. Like, this is coming at a moment in which we've had a lot of good news on this front. Organizations like yours have been kind of flooding the zone with naloxone, this drug that can reverse an overdose as it's happening and save a lot of lives. And we've seen overdose death rates go way, way down and reversals go up, right?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that brought me to Sonoran Prevention Works in the first place were these remarkable metrics. The numbers are just extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So we have more reversals in Arizona than we have deaths at this point in time. That is not possible without a sort of a whole of government approach and a whole approach of partner organizations in the nonprofit world.
Right. So you're concerned, though, that policies like this ordinance might reverse that trend. Tell us why.
Well, they may start out with a good premise that everybody should enjoy the parks, and nobody wants to change that. But you don't have to over-regulate things that are not serious problems in order to achieve that. And what the ordinance does is it regulates speech as if it were conduct. So it treats providing information and resources that can be used to mitigate and lessen risk. It treats that as if it's medical treatment, and it is not.
Right. So it prohibits people from providing, as you're saying, providing medical treatment in a public park, but also promoting, advertising, sponsoring, that kind of thing in a park. I mean, is the idea here to prohibit syringes, needle exchanges, things like that?
So the sponsors of the legislation and the proponents of it speak in exactly those terms: public safety, making the parks welcoming, friendly, making certain that vulnerable young kids are not exposed to seeing things that their parents might not want them to see. So I understand those concerns, but the response from the city is to regulate conduct that isn't problematic in order to prevent conduct that they see as definitely problematic. What our organization does and what our partner organizations do, they're not providing medical treatment. Mm-hmm. They are not facilitating anybody's use of any substance in the park. They're providing resources, whether that's information or physical resources to manage that risk.
Is that like the harm reduction kits, which are also prohibited from being given out in parks here?
They're absolutely prohibited under the new ordinance. So just this weekend, Sunday, after church services in my own congregation, my congregation put together what we call at SPW sick kits. Mm-hmm. Those include electrolytes, some sanitizer, some ibuprofen. And those sick kits are harm reduction kits. Hmm. They are useful for people who are experiencing nausea or some other distress because of how they may be consuming substances. The ordinance makes it okay for me to tell people about those supplies but not provide them. Really, we can't provide ibuprofen to people in a sealed packet.
But other harm reduction kits will include other things, right?
They can include lots of other things.
So would there be like a clean syringe in another harm reduction kit or something like that, naloxone, et cetera?
So there are yes, there could be. So for example, we have naloxone kits. Those naloxone kits have two specific syringes and two doses of naloxone and instructions. Mm-hmm. Other types of kits might include a different type of syringe, clean syringes that are specifically legal under state law in Arizona as part of the state's legalization of syringe service programs just a few years ago.
Right, which made a big difference. That we should say this ordinance does not apply to administering naloxone. The city also passed an ordinance that will criminalize people from using park equipment for anything other than its quote-unquote intended purpose. Does this feel just like directed at people who are unhoused?
It's absolutely, unfortunately, directed at some of the most vulnerable people in society, the unhoused. And as a result of a Supreme Court decision just a year plus ago, it has become legal for cities to regulate houselessness in a way that they didn't previously have. Mm-hmm. So, for example, that was the green light to remove the zone in downtown Phoenix. And the people who are unhoused, they didn't disappear. They were just displaced. And as a result of that type of enforcement activity, many unhoused people are now residing in the only places that really had been available to them, public parks and other areas where they can sleep.
Yeah. So this is an effort, you feel like, at least by the city, to move them out of public parks. Where will they go?
Well, that's the question. Part of the very core of harm reduction is meeting people where they are. And we know empirically that we're going to find more unhoused people in public parks. If they are not there, there's still some other place. If they are not there, they are harder to reach. If they are harder to reach, they are less likely to receive information and resources that they need. If they do not receive those resources, they are more likely to suffer adverse consequences, including overdose and death. That's what the city has just enacted.
So you think like this could actually make it worse, like more people will be dying as opposed to getting this help?
So let me put it this way. There will be fewer calls for service for people reporting activity that they find distasteful in the mm-hmm. parks, and more reports that require EMT or ambulance runs to people who have overdosed because they did not receive the services. Mm. And unfortunately, more people dying, whether they die in the park because they've overdosed there or adjacent to it or in some other location or in my front lawn.
All right, we'll leave it there. Scott Greenwood, the CEO of Sonoran Prevention Works, joining us to talk about the city ordinance passed by the city of Phoenix. Scott, thank you for coming in. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, as always.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from Phoenix Vice Mayor Keisha Hodge Washington, who voted for the new ordinance. Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law will be hosting a job fair tomorrow. There will be tables set up during lunch where students can meet with prospective employers and then an evening reception. But one entity that was set to be recruiting is drawing the ire of some students, ICE. The law school's Chicano Latino Law Students Association put out a statement on social media calling on ASU to revoke ICE's invitation, saying in part, "For our community, ICE is not just an employer. It represents family separation, detention, and fear. Allowing ICE to recruit students in a space that should be reserved for collaboration and learning sends a message that these harms are disconnected from the lived realities of our students," end quote. And as of this hour, according to the group, ICE will in fact no longer be taking part in the job fair. Maya Dominguez is a third-year law student at ASU and vice president of external relations for the Chicano Latino Law Students Association. She came by the studio earlier this morning to talk about this before the news about ICE pulling out. And I asked what her and her group's concerns were about having that agency as part of the job fair.
Yeah, so our main concern is that it's quite exclusionary. So our club as a whole exists to be welcoming and ensure that everyone feels at home at school because we do spend so much time there, and so we should feel safe there. So we believe that inviting ICE to campus in any entity, whether it's their attorneys, which is who would be recruiting us, to ICE agents, whatever capacity, we believe that it's not representative of what ASU law should represent. All students should feel safe on campus.
Do you or do you think that your classmates will feel unsafe with ICE attorneys on campus?
We do, especially with all the recent events. Right now, ICE is not just a government agency. It's something that represents fear and harm, especially given the recent events in Minnesota. So we don't want that to be on our campus and especially not in our building recruiting our students.
For you, is it more of a symbolic thing? Like, given everything going on, you don't want representatives from this agency? Or are you actually concerned that, like, ICE might come in and, I don't know, arrest law students, arrest your classmates because they might be suspected of being here illegally?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a both. We don't want them in any capacity on our campus, but then inviting them onto our campus, who knows what they'll interpret that invitation to be, whether that's just the attorney's aspect of it or if that's also inviting agents in, if they might suspect someone. You know, there are students at our school that are mixed status, undocumented, DACA, whatever it might be. And so that's not okay for them to feel excluded from that event because they might not feel comfortable going and speaking to all the other agencies and nonprofits that are there because of this invitation that was sent out.
What have you heard from classmates of yours, both those who are maybe in your club and those who are not?
There's been kind of an overall distrust and desire not to have ICE on campus for this specific event. I do know that there are multiple organizations that have released statements or that have kind of signed on to our own statement as well in support of what we're asking for to revoke that invitation.
What have you heard from the university about this or from the law school specifically?
We have not heard any response to it. Hopefully we do hear a response. We haven't heard from either ICE as a whole or the university.
Have you reached out to ICE to ask them questions about them coming here?
We haven't, but our statement has reached our community as a whole. So it's reached attorneys, alumni, like we're assuming government agencies, because our Instagram account has a bunch of alumni and attorneys in the community, and they have been very active, and they've started their own petition actually based off of our statement, kind of urging ASU to revoke that invitation to ICE.
Okay. So we reached out to the law school and we heard back from ASU. I'm not going to read the entire statement to you, but basically the gist of it was ASU does not pick and choose which agencies come. And in fact, the spokesperson said that legally the university can't preclude an agency from coming to a job fair. I'm curious. I know you're just hearing this now, but I'm curious what you make of that.
Thinking about that, it does seem interesting. I understand the kind of you can't discriminate against like certain agencies. I do think it comes down to a matter of the school standing with its students and protecting its students. Obviously, I don't know the exact logistics behind that, but I think that as a school, they should be protecting their students first and foremost, whether that means revoking the invitation, whether that means putting certain limitations on the invitation, saying, you know, it can only be the lawyer aspect of ICE that is here to recruit and that's it. Just because having them there as a whole is disturbing to many of the much of the student body. And so I think that the school should be standing by its students first and foremost.
So given that ICE will be at this event, is it changing how you are thinking about attending or how you are just in general thinking about this event? I mean, you're going to be going out into the world of work not that long from now.
Yeah. So I know that there are a couple people who are like, I don't even want to go to the event anymore. I do know that there have been like concerns that there could be a protest right outside, which would cause interruptions to the networking between students and other agencies as well. And so I think it kind of as a whole is a bad idea in many aspects to have them there just because it could disrupt so many things in so many different aspects.
Are you still planning on going?
I'm not planning on going. I have been to that event before, and as a 3L, I am not currently in the job search, but I'm not sure that I would attend regardless, even if I was hoping to go because of ICE's presence there. One important thing that our statement really kind of hinges on is that in the university charter, so broader than just the law school, it says that the university measures itself not by whom it excludes, but by whom it includes. And so I think that is really telling of what ASU is meant to be and what the school as a whole, ASU Law as a part of that, should be abiding by.
All right. Well, Maya, thank you so much for coming in and talking about this. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for inviting me.
Maya Dominguez is a third-year law student at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law and vice president for the Chicano Latino Law Students Association. As we discussed, we did reach out to ASU about this. In a statement, a university spokesperson said in part, quote, ASU does not prohibit municipal, state, or federal law enforcement agencies or branches of the U.S. military from participating in employment-related opportunities on campus. Federal laws and policies prevent discrimination against such agencies, and some members of the ASU community may choose to pursue legal careers with those agencies, end quote. And again, the group said earlier this hour that ICE would no longer be at the job fair. We will post both the group's statement and ASU's response at theshow.kjzz.org. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Well, Jesse Johnson is a stand-up comedian who grew up here in the Valley, and she is really starting to make a name for herself. She recently toured the world with fellow stand-ups Andrew Santino and Bobby Lee, and she performs regularly at LA's legendary Comedy Store, one of the premier venues in the country. But before all that, Jesse was on a very different journey. She grew up playing classical music on the trumpet. She went to NAU on a trumpet scholarship, envisioning a life for herself as a touring musician. But then, she told me recently, things took a turn.
To keep the scholarship I had, it was a full ride scholarship, but to keep it, I was so overloaded with work. There were so many classes and requirements to keep, and I was also simultaneously doing a lot of drugs. Can I say that on here?
Yeah, it's fine.
Psychedelics, maybe I don't name all of them. So I was, but that's what I was taught in school. Like, it was like, I was taught, like, if you want to play like the greats, you know, live how they live their lives. And a lot of musicians I looked up to, Miles Davis, you know, mm-hmm. You know, they were all like experimented in drugs. So I was like, oh, I want to be great.
Yeah.
And so I was doing that, and then it just got me esoteric, and I ended up dropping out of school.
Can I ask, did you feel like it helped your playing? The drugs?
It didn't. Mm-hmm. It completely ruined my life for a while. Yeah. But I think, if I'm being completely honest, in hindsight, I am glad I did them. And I hesitate because I don't like advocating for that.
Sure.
But I do enjoy my perspective on life, and I like my mind. And I don't know if I would have gotten here without those experiences. I ended up going back. It's funny. I got another full ride scholarship at Mesa Community College.
Wow.
On trumpet playing. And then I quit that because I think when you have a calling, somebody told me once that your calling, you don't choose it. It chooses you.
Yeah.
or your purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think as much as I had this trajectory towards music, something else was pulling me somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I went to Scottsdale Community College and simultaneously joined this sketch comedy group.
And so when you joined the sketch group in Scottsdale,
it felt like my life had been saved. I felt, yeah, because I was in such a bad place.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine you have like all this potential and everyone believes in you. And then you kind of just like, next thing you know, you don't even know you did it, but it's like gone. Just being part of a, like belonging somewhere, it like really helped me work towards something.
So I kind of see a connection there between, you know, if you're a trumpeter, generally speaking, you're playing in an ensemble. When you're doing sketch, generally speaking, you're part of an ensemble, right? At a certain point, you decided to get up there by yourself.
Well, the first place I did stand up was at the Ice House Tavern.
Yes.
You've been there?
I have been there.
That place rocks. It's a little dive bar attached to a hockey rink behind a Walmart. And the whole wall behind the bar is a glass window to the rink.
Mm-hmm.
It seats like, what, 40?
Yeah.
It's tiny.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, we do open mics there. It was a crazy experience because you'd be doing jokes and then a fight would like break out against the glass. You know, like hockey pucks would hit this side. Crazy environment to start in because you had all distractions.
Right. Do you remember the jokes you did your first time up?
So bad. Like what kind of tea does a camel drink? Camel meal. Like cringeworthy.
But at a certain point, I have to imagine people started reacting more to your jokes rather than, I see you trying to do jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
And they got to a place where they saw you executing jokes and were like, hey, that's good. Hey, I like that.
Yeah.
Do you remember any particular moment where that happened?
Yeah, I do. Again, you might have to like bleep it out.
That's fine.
But I remember the first joke I did that got like a reaction that I was like shocked. Like I was like, whoa, I could get laughs like that. I just walked out there and I was so awkward and nervous, like way nervous on stage. And I just, the first thing I said was, and I got this like huge pop. Yeah, I remember just after I said it and be like, oh, now I know how to get the laugh. Because I was thinking, okay, when I go up there, what do people see? And they see someone who looks really young. So I'm going to acknowledge that. It's like you want to like kind of direct the thoughts and then take it somewhere like that they don't even see it coming. Like it made me go, whoa. So I was like, if it makes me think like that, it's going to make an audience freak out. That was that moment of, oh, okay, I could really play around with people's expectations.
Got it. I'm curious what you make of Phoenix audiences
specifically? You know, having now moved to LA, done stand-up all over the place, what do you think characterizes Phoenix audiences? And I ask that because I have seen lots of comics who aren't from here come through town, play venues like the Tempe Improv, Stand Up Live, and they really struggle.
That's interesting because my experience is it's like the best crowds ever.
Okay.
But maybe I just relate better, you know, because I grew up in the desert.
Right.
I know what it's like. I know that what the heat's like. I know it's like when we had the I-10 shooter and everyone just kept going to work. Like, that's a crazy place we live in. Like, not a lot phases people out here, you know. People die just from the heat every year. Like, this is a tough town.
Uh-huh.
It's just decorated with grass and palm trees now, but it's still like the West, you know.
Yeah.
I think people who live here for a long time, they just kind of have like a roughness to them where you gotta really like catch them off guard maybe. Growing up, my parents were very hands-off, very Siddhartha, like, make your own mistakes, learn from it. And boy, did I.
Very Siddhartha. That's a good way of putting it.
So I don't know. I made so many mistakes young. I think you hear a lot of stand-ups, more so in the 70s than now, but like as stand-ups that they get into stand-up, they get famous or whatever that is, and then they start doing drugs.
Yeah.
And then they mess up their life. Like, I luckily did that already.
Okay, yeah. So one of the things about you that is true to you that is still a part of your act is your trumpet.
Yes.
And you have your trumpet with you today in the studio.
I don't know if it's right. I don't know if it's funny. I don't know if it's comedy. But there's something in it that is like pulling me towards it. And the latest is I've like started using pedals and mutes and like electronifying it.
Cool. Well, that is what we have set up here in the studio. So if you wouldn't mind, perhaps you could favor us with a little bit of pedal infused trumpet.
Yeah, let's see if this is all. Yeah, I don't know if this is comedy, but it's not tame.
Definitely makes me think about Miles Davis.
Yeah, no, it's just fun to like. But, you know, and I feel like then almost anything you say after it, like, it's already, the tension's already there of, like, what's she gonna say? So there's something to it. I'm excited to explore it. I don't know. I could open my show like that.
That's so amazing.
What's up, Tempe?
Well, those are the sweet trumpet sounds and the voice of my guest, Jesse Johnson. Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sam, any thought that maybe she could tell jokes while playing the trumpet?
Ooh, now that would be
It'd be
pretty
a skill.
Innovative stage presence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of, not sure it's humanly possible, but maybe she'll figure it out.
No, we could also hire her. You know, some morning shows have like an air horn when something funny happens. We could hire her to do that.
Fair. We'll see if it's in the budget. All right. Well, that'll do it for this edition of the show. Thanks, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.